Will people who want to say something go to the microphones? And those of you who are leaving, would you mind doing it quietly so others can hear? Thanks. Go ahead. I'll just alternate, starting over here and then over here, okay?
Okay.
It's kind of hard for me to see you, so if I miss somebody, make yourselves visible.
I guess what I want to ask about is activism, is what can be done. And I want to preface it by saying I'm with Colorado Freeze Voter, and we're in the process of organizing to make sure Ken Kramer is not the next senator. And in fact, the number of people in this room could accomplish that by helping on election day. Hello, is this, yeah.
By helping?
On election day. Before, we have these little yellow slips we've been handing out to organize volunteers to help get the vote out. It's going to be get out the vote that makes the difference in this election. So I'd like everybody who can to get one and get it back to us. And the question I have for you is, what can we do? Do elections matter? What do you think?
Yeah, elections matter. We shouldn't, in fact, they matter to the extent that the population creates a crisis of democracy. I mean, if elections are just something in which some portion of the population goes and pushes a button every couple of years, elections don't matter. In fact, they're irrelevant. On the other hand, if the public organizes to press its position, elections do matter. If citizens are constantly pressing their representatives, they can make a difference. Now, the difference, the way our system works, it's the amount of organization and the amount of pressure that counts. Now, notice what that means is kind of obvious, and everybody who thinks about it knows it. Your congressional representative can be influenced much more easily than your senator, and the senator can be influenced somewhat more easily than the president, who's essentially immune. When you get to the level of the executive, policy answers almost totally to elite groups, basically those who own the society and manage it. At the level of congressional representatives, popular opinion makes a difference because you can organize at a scale which will influence your representative. You can get your congressional representative to come to your home, for example, and get a group of neighbors and yell at him, or have people sit in his office, or whatever works. It depends on the circumstances, and it can make a difference. Often it can make an important difference. So for example, take, say, Contra Aid. That came close. A little more political activism could have swung that vote, which would have made a tremendous difference in the amount of torture and murder and destruction in Central America. We didn't do it. We failed. And it could have been done at the congressional level. When you're trying to reverse things like the arms race, it's harder, because there you're talking about real institutional structures, which are very hard to change. Nevertheless, things can be done. For example, it would be possible to put, I think, it might be possible, let's say, to put enough pressure on Congress to impose, to essentially compel the government to join the comprehensive test ban and to extend it to a comprehensive ban on both nuclear weapons tests and missiles. Now, every arms analyst will tell you what that means. What that means is that the threat of a first strike erodes. That's a protection against a first strike. It's a costless, verifiable protection against a first strike. Frankly, I think a first strike is a total fantasy. But anyone who believes this stuff knows that to carry out a first strike, let's get into the world of illusion in which people talk about these things, that to carry out a first strike requires very high confidence in your weapons. A test ban, including a missile ban, will over time erode confidence. Therefore, it's a costless, literally, and certainly verifiable way of achieving what SDI, Star Wars, is theoretically supposed to achieve. It might be possible to get the United States to join that. That would have long-term effects. It wouldn't change the system right off, but it would have the effect of beginning to modify the system of industrial management, which uses the Pentagon as the way of forcing the public to subsidize high-tech industry. And it would, if it was combined with another parallel citizens' effort to block intervention, and hence to undermine the necessity for a nuclear umbrella to permit it to continue, you could imagine very significant changes in the country. But that takes a scale of protest that's well beyond a group of people here and there sitting in at their congressman's office or inviting your representative to your house. it's a matter of scale. Sure, elections can matter, you know, if they are just the forward edge of a citizenry that's really insisting on participating in determining policy at every stage of the game, from planning through implementation. If elections are just something that you show up for every once in a while, you're just playing a game designed by elites, you know.
As you may know, there's been a lot of activity here on campus with regard to the Central Intelligence Agency and the CIA. And there's also been a lot, well, not a lot, but relatively a lot in the mainstream media about the role of the CIA in Central America recently because of Hassan Fuss and a few other things. And I'm wondering if you can comment a little bit on the role of the CIA in Central America and maybe relate that to the fact that there was a recent congressional study which said that the CIA needed more money because they weren't carrying out their intelligence factor.
Yeah. Well, the CIA in Central America is, what they're doing in secret, nobody, you know, one that doesn't know, and there is no doubt that nobody should be surprised that an administration committed to lawlessness, will find complex ways to evade congressional restrictions, just as it snubs its nose at international law and the World Court. Obviously. So nobody should be surprised at the discovery that the Reagan administration had established a complex network to provide AIM arms for what it itself calls its proxy army in violation of congressional restrictions. However, it's harder than if it's open. And in fact, now it's open. The worst feature of the recent congressional vote was not so much the $100 million. A lawless administration will find a way to fund its terrorist army one way or another. The worst feature of it was the involvement of the CIA, which is now open and legitimate. Now, you know, sources have already leaked that means right off about $400 million in CIA funds, but the point is it's essentially endless. The CIA does what it wants. Theoretically, there's senatorial control, but since it's secret, it doesn't exist. That means that now the CIA can escalate the war as it chooses with limitless funds. Now, the United States is a very rich, powerful, and also very violent and murderous state. No small country can possibly resist this kind of attack. We could buy up the whole country and turn it into mercenaries, you know, given the relative scale. We can carry out massive terror. There's almost no limits to what the United States can do. I mean, just look at the comparison between the United States and Nicaragua. I mean, it's ridiculous. So once the CIA is let loose, essentially the bars are down. And that, apart from what that means to Nicaragua and maybe the rest of the region, we might bear in mind that it has other possible consequences. For example, one thing that the CIA might try to do, if the CIA's terrorist army cannot succeed in its aims of it's already succeeded, notice. The United States has already won the war, essentially. We have forced the Sandinistas to divert resources away from social reforms, exactly as the government states, and that opens the way for every hypocrite in the United States, as I said, to point to that fact as their failure and therefore to argue that we have to go attack them more, just as any commissar would say under comparable circumstances in the Soviet Union. So that's already won. Now the only question is, can we pursue it to the point where we restore, where we do, say, what the liberal editors of the Washington Post tell us ought to be done, I'm quoting now, to restore Nicaragua to the Central American mode? Can we turn it into a state based on terror and torture like El Salvador and Guatemala? Or can we return it to a state like Honduras where half the population is starving to death? Can we do that, is what they're asking. Well, maybe we can. If the terrorist army can't succeed in that itself, the CIA, once it's involved, will do other things. For example, they may begin to do what they began to do before the congressional restrictions were imposed, to use high technology resources, where we, of course, dominate, to impose a blockade on Nicaragua. Now, you can do that with high-speed boats, the same Piranha speedboats that were used to bomb the ports and attack the oil installations in some of the many activities which were condemned by the World Court as aggression. Remember, aggression is the crime that people were hanged for after World War II. So you can continue with those operations. Nicaragua plainly can't stop them. They don't have the technology to stop them. But those operations will, if they move towards a blockade, they'll be directed particularly against Cuban and Soviet shipping. Cuba and the Soviet Union have means to respond. If they choose to carry out those means, if they choose to defend their shipping against an American attack, you can be quite certain that the American media and the American liberal congressmen will express incredible outrage over this new demonstration of communist aggression and their desire to conquer the world, as illustrated by the fact that they're defending their ships against our attack. And that's what will happen, and in fact we will then respond by escalating the violence. It doesn't take long for that to go to a global war, not long at all. In fact, in that respect, the United States is once again playing with fire. So quite apart from what all this means for the region, it also means a not inconsiderable threat of global war. Well, that's the CIA in Central America. Of course, that's not the only place where they're active. You can tell other stories in the rest of the world, and it's not just the CIA. We have many resources of violence. For example, we use client states. You'll have noticed that in the current Hassanfuss story, it has surfaced that the United States is using Saudi Arabia as a way of funneling arms to the terrorist army. And notice, if you think it through, notice how intricate this planning is. Just as in the cases I mentioned, the planners are not stupid. Just look at the fine print of what's coming out in the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal today, and you'll notice the following. In 1981, the Reagan administration supported sending AWACS, you know, super high-tech surveillance aircraft, to Saudi Arabia over the opposition of the Israeli lobby. It's kind of unusual. They rarely are willing to run that political risk, but this time they did it, which means they had a real reason. And notice, incidentally, that when state policy is involved, the Israeli lobby is not very significant. They're only significant when they conform to state policy. So in this case, the government overrode the Israeli lobby, which is a powerful political force, and sent AWACS to Saudi Arabia. Well, it wasn't so obvious then what was the big stake. Now we know. The big stake was lining up Saudi Arabia in the United States' crusade for international terrorism in Central America. We use Israel for the same purpose, incidentally. As I mentioned, contrary to many falsehoods, under the Carter administration, American arms to the murderous regime of Guatemala continued at virtually the norm, even publicly. That's what Pentagon official figures say. What was going on by other means is another story, more certainly. But it wasn't enough because there was a rather significant war going on, and Congress was preventing the American executive from participating directly. So we used proxies. We used Argentine neo-Nazis, who, in the words of Brian Jenkins, the RAND Corporation specialist on terrorism, were proxies for the United States. We used Taiwan, but primarily we used Israel, just as we're using Saudi Arabia to support terrorists attacking Nicaragua. We were using Israeli specialists to support state terrorism in Guatemala, and it was effective. The numbers killed in those years are estimated roughly at about 75,000, which is not inconsiderable. And again, brutal murder, brutal torture and murder all the way through. And that's happened. We do the same in our efforts to destabilize Southern Africa, what's called constructive engagement. That requires supporting South Africa, as it required supporting Rhodesia and undermining the international boycott against Rhodesia. Well, we use Israel for that purpose, and probably Saudi Arabia too. The United States has many, it's a very powerful state. There hasn't been such a powerful state in history, even today, and it has many mechanisms that it can use for its purposes of, in this case, international terrorism. CIA is one, but it's not the only one. It's an important one.
Yes, you spoke briefly about the mass media a while ago, and I'd like for you to expand on that. Who, in your opinion, how do they control the mass media, and who does it?
Well, the mass media are, in the first place, major corporations. you know, that's what they are. They are some of the biggest corporations in the country, and they're closely interlocked with other corporations. In fact, they are part of the small network of individuals and interests which effectively own the private economy and staff the state executive. If you look at the people who hold the high planning positions in the state executive under any administration, they come from corporate boardrooms, investment banks, half a dozen law firms that cater to corporate interests, and so on. There are a number of studies of this if you're interested. That's the same group of people, the same interests who own the media. So naturally they share a perception of the world and general interests. That's at the top level. Now I suppose you get down to the editorial level, or the reporter's level. Well, you know, at that point, you find pressures to conform. A young journalist, will quickly learn that certain things are reportable and other things aren't. You can say things in a certain way and you can't say things in other ways. And you learn it from your editors, or the people right above you, and they've learned it from the people right above them. Remember, corporations are the private equivalent of what we call fascism in the political realm. The decision-making structure in a corporation is top-down. You give orders and they get executed by down below and so on and so forth, and the orders ultimately come from the owners. Furthermore, the media have a market. That market is other corporations. The market for the media is advertisers. Remember, the media do not make their money on sales to you and me. In fact, every purchase of a newspaper or journal usually costs them money. Right? That's the way the political economy of the media work. Their market is advertisers, which imposes yet another constraint. They want to maintain a relationship to the state, which is their friends. You know, there's a kind of interpenetration up and back. In fact, even the individuals flow up and back. You know, Bernard Kalb, Leslie Gelb, et cetera, et cetera. Of course they flow up and back because they represent the same interests. There's a constant flow between corporate boardrooms, state managers, media executives and top-level media people, university elites who play the game by the rules and so on. They all belong to the same privileged elite. They all benefit the same way. They perceive the world the same way. If any of them get out of line, they're excluded. And that can happen even at a very high level. So, for example, a couple of years ago, the top editorial staff of the New York Times was essentially thrown out, John Oakes and others, because they were beginning to deviate a little bit. Time, and how did it, if you look at the mechanisms, it's very clear. A couple of years, I think it was about the mid-70s, there began to be reports in the business press, the Wall Street Journal, the Business Week, saying, pointing out subtly that New York Times stock was declining on the stock market. And they pointed out, here I'm quoting, they said, if the New York Times doesn't realize that it's a business, soon it won't be in business any longer. Well, and in fact, they did replace a good part of the top editorial board at that time. What was the great crime that the New York Times was committing at that point? Well, if you look back, it turns out that they were editorially supporting some very mild fiscal reform measures that business didn't happen to like. And that was enough to set in motion the technique of control. You'll notice that the state is under exactly the same technique of control in a capitalist democracy. Suppose that the state, in fact, is staffed by those who have resources. But suppose it tried to deviate. Suppose it started to pursue policies that didn't conform to the interests of those who make the investment decisions, who essentially own the place. Well, what would happen, in fact does happen, is a decline in investment, the beginning of capital flight, just a little bit, enough to tell them that the country's going to go down the tube unless they go back to the main course. Now, what that means is that when true decision-making power is in private hands, the political system is marginal and the ideological institutions are limited. And incidentally, these conditions almost never arise because they're all staffed by people with the same interests and the same background and the same perception anyway. Getting back again to the reporter, they just shape up or else they're out. And what typically, incidentally, this happens in universities too. Those of you who are going on in the ideological professions, the social sciences and so on, you'll learn this. You'll learn that you gotta conform. Now, it's not 100%. You know, the system is willing to tolerate statistical error. But it's got to be enough so that there isn't any significant deviation. And you do come under pressures to conform, all sorts of pressures. You'll find out what they are if you don't know already. And those pressures are effective. What they do is weed out independent people. And for the people who decide to, there's also something very interesting which you might as well be aware of if you haven't faced it yet, because it'll happen. What happens is that if you decide, well, I'll conform a little, you know, I'll do what they say, but I'll keep my independence of mind, as soon as you begin to do that, you're lost, unless you're a very rare individual. Because what happens is you begin to conform, you begin to get the privilege of conformity, you soon come to believe what you're saying because it's useful to believe it, and then you've internalized the system of indoctrination and distortion and deception, and then you're a willing member of the privileged elites that control thought and indoctrination. That happens all the time, all the way to the top, you know. I mean, it's a very rare person, very rare, almost to the point of non-existence, who can tolerate what's called cognitive dissonance, you know, saying one thing and believing another. You start saying certain things because it's necessary to say them, and pretty soon you're believing them, because you just have to. There is no atrocity, in my view, that we know of, that has been carried out in the world that wasn't justified by its perpetrators as highly moral. That includes, incidentally, Nazi genocide. You know, you read Himmler's diaries to go to the sort of extreme, and it's all full of how noble this is and how much strength it requires and so on and so forth. Slavery was justified by the slave owners with moral arguments. If we had records from Attila the Hun, we'd probably find out that what he was doing was highly moral, you know, same with Stalin and every mass murderer in history. And it happens at a much lower level for individuals. Incidentally, you're all familiar with this from your personal lives, and it's worth bearing in mind. So, like, I doubt if there's anybody here who hasn't done pretty rotten things in their life at some time, but I also am willing to bet that every one of you has figured out a way to make that exactly the right and moral and proper thing to do, okay? And that's what happens when you become parts of institutions, too. So that's the way the indoctrination works on the participants. And it ends up being a very effective system, ultimately rooted in control over resources, exactly as you'd expect. It's not very mysterious. Some people talk about it as a conspiracy theory. That's really idiotic. It's not a conspiracy. You know, like if the board of managers of General Motors decides to maximize profit, that's not a conspiracy. In fact, if they didn't do it, they'd be thrown out. You know, that's the institutional role they have to play. And the ideological institutions also have a role that they have to play within a nexus of institutions, and if they don't play that role, or if individuals within them don't play that role, they'll be replaced by others who do, because these are institutional facts, like the arms race.
Yes. First of all, let me thank you and compliment you on your conversion to realizing that Pol Pot was a mass murderer, and you've finally seen the light on that, have you, Mr. Chomsky?
No, I've seen exactly the light that I saw at the beginning. There's been a vast amount of lying on this topic, including an article which happens to be right before me in today's Daily Camera.
Which I wrote.
Which you wrote. Well, let me describe to you the... Okay. Then, fine, then let me... Okay. There's no time here. You know, it takes a phrase to produce a lie and 10 minutes to decode it, so I'll just take one, the one you've just mentioned. Let's take the Pol Pot atrocities, okay? You say here somewhere that everybody knows that Pol Pot killed 2 million people or some phrase to that extent, something like that. Okay, let's look at that 2 million people and what I wrote about it.
He killed no one, according to you, right? In this
Pardon?
Book here. In this book by you, you say he killed
yes.
virtually no one.
After the cataclysm.
Yes.
And you can look and check exactly what I'm saying.
You said it was a well-orchestrated campaign
yes.
of hysteria.
And may I finish
yes.
on the 2 million? Okay. The figure of 2 million people killed was produced in February 1977. This is all described in detail in the book by Jean Lacouture, a French journalist, who was reviewing a book by a French priest named François Panchaud, which had just come out in French. It was fine. About a year or two later, it was translated into English. And you can read it if you don't read French. It was called Cambodia Year Zero. That was the only book at that point by anyone who had any direct or sort of plausible knowledge of what was going on in Cambodia. So it was an important book. It appeared in France in January 1977. It was immediately reviewed in the New York Review of Books, translating an article, a review that just appeared in France.
Did you kind of come to the point?
I'll get to the point.
The review and all that.
I told you it takes 10 minutes to decode a lie, and I'm now decoding it. Okay. In this review, Jean Lacouture stated that according to Pinchot, Pol Pot had killed, in fact, they didn't talk about Pol Pot because nobody knew him then. He said the Khmer Rouge have boasted, that was his word, of killing 2 million people. That's where the figure of 2 million comes from that you've heard over and over again since. Well, I was interested. I hadn't seen figures like that. And the book was not available in the United States. Incidentally, Lacouture's review was immediately picked up by the press, quoted all over the place. Oh, isn't this fantastic? I'm horrifying. They've killed 2 million people. Incidentally, in July 1975, 2 years earlier, the New York Times had already accused them of genocide. But now we had support from Pinchot, the French priest, high source, says they killed 2 million people. Well, I had no opinion on it one way or another. So I did the obvious thing. I wrote to some friends in France and asked them to mail me the book, because no copy of it existed in the United States. It was being quoted all over the place. Everybody was quoting it, but it didn't exist. So I got a copy of the French book. And here's what I discovered. Here's the source of your 2 million figures. I discovered that according to Pinchot, the United States was responsible for the death of 800,000 Cambodians in the bombing, in the war, in the first half of the decade. And then he says, according to the American embassy, the Pol Pot regime is responsible for 1.2 million deaths from all causes, including killing, starvation, overwork, etc. All right, Lacouture read that. He added up the two figures, the alleged claim of the American embassy and Pinchot's claim about the American war, added them up, comes to 2 million, attributed it all to Pol Pot. That was the 2 million figure. Well, I did the next obvious thing. I wrote a personal letter to Lacouture in which I said, look, I don't know what's going on in Cambodia, but you misquoted Pinchot. I gave a series of misquotes. It turns out that every reference of his to the book was
a
total
fault. May I interrupt you
for a moment? May I continue?
We have some Cambodian
May I continue?
Older.
I will, just a second. You asked me to talk about your particular lie. I will now talk about it, okay? If you wanted me to talk about other lies, I'll talk about them. If you'll bear with me on this, it's a very illuminating story about the way a system of indoctrination works and about the way commissars work. Let's continue.
Cambodians and Burmese.
May I continue?
Let's go.
May I continue? It's plain that you don't want to hear this, and I understand why, but let me continue anyway. I won't take the time to go through the other lies. I just mentioned that one. Okay, I mentioned to Lacouture that his falsification of Pinchot's book was now being widely quoted, and I thought that was improper. I thought he ought to report what Pinchot actually said. He then wrote an article which appeared in the United States, in which he thanked me for calling to his attention a number of errors. In fact, it turned out everything that he'd referred to was totally false, but let's forget that. And he corrected a few of them, not all, but a few. In the case of the number of people killed, here's what he said. He said, maybe the number killed was thousands or hundreds of thousands. But he said, did it really matter? In other words, did it really matter whether the actual number was in the thousands or in the millions? No, he said, it doesn't matter. It's about the same. And everyone thought that was just wonderful and very heroic. And after that, everyone continued to quote the 2 million figure, even after he had said, well, maybe it's in the thousands. And of course, I misquoted. Now, just imagine that somebody had were to say that about an American atrocity, you know? I mean, like in El Salvador, the United States is responsible for 50,000 deaths in the last 5 years. Suppose somebody came along and said, well, it's 50 million deaths or 5 billion deaths, factor of 1,000. Suppose somebody wrote, the United States is responsible for 5 billion deaths, you know, or 50 million deaths in El Salvador. And then suppose somebody said, well, look, you know, you misquoted and so on. And he says, well, after all, what's a factor of 1,000, you know? I mean, we would think that that's ludicrous. Of course a factor of 1,000 matters. It matters whether it's 1,000 killed is an atrocity. But millions killed, in particular a boast of millions killed, that's a very different atrocity. Factor of a, you know, these things didn't matter. Factor of 100, a factor of 1,000, all of those things matter. I wrote an article, after Lacouture said he didn't think it mattered, but a colleague of mine named Edward Herman, an economist at the University of Pennsylvania, he and I wrote an article in The Nation in which we gave the first actual review of Panchaud's book. Panchaud's book is the standard source on this, and we wrote the first review of it. I discount Lacouture's review because everything in it was totally false. The book had not yet appeared in English, but we wrote a review of the book in The Nation. It's June 25th, 1977. You can look it up. And in it, we praised Panchaud's book as serious and worth reading, with its report of the grisly atrocities committed by the Khmer Rouge and their barbarity. And we said we have no idea what the actual numbers are. How could we know? But on the basis of his book, they're probably serious. And we ran through the range of we also said we disagreed with Lacouture about the question of a factor of 1,000. We thought it mattered whether the number killed was in the thousands or the millions. Incidentally, in the same review, we also pointed out that Panchaud had very significantly exaggerated the atrocities due to the American bombing. You'll notice that nobody's minded that. We have never been criticized for pointing out that Panchaud exaggerated the number of killings due to the United States. Excuse me. No, he's not. I'll go on with the rest. Yeah, that was the first book that existed, and it's the major source. Okay, and that's all we wrote at that time. Okay, that's the basis of your first. Then in the book that you're, the book that you're talking about was written in 1978, and it appeared in 1979 after the fall of the Pol Pot regime. Written in 1978, it used more evidence up through early 1978. Now, in that book, we started off by saying that the Khmer Rouge are responsible for what we called gruesome atrocities, and we went on to describe them. And we then, but our book was not about Cambodia. It was about the American propaganda system. This is one chapter in a two-volume work on the American propaganda system, in which we compared the way the other guys' atrocities are treated with the way our atrocities are treated. And the point that we made with two volumes of documentation is that when it's the other guys' atrocities, the press vastly exaggerates them and fabricates and so on, and when it's our atrocities, they suppress them and remain quiet about them and so on. One of dozens of cases discussed is Cambodia, and we pointed out this example, but we also pointed out something else. We pointed out that the only people who knew anything about Cambodia was American intelligence. Okay? I mean, they actually had evidence about Cambodia. They were monitoring it closely. And in fact, by then, I had contacted State Department intelligence to find out what they were saying, and it's given in there. What they were saying, first of all, they said that this claim of Panchaud's about 1.2 million was an invention. They had never produced any such thing. And then they said, and in fact, this was said in public, and we quoted in the book, in mid-1977, which is about the latest evidence, they said that the number of people killed by, they said that no doubt that there are atrocities, they said it's in the tens or hundreds of thousands, not from mass genocide, but from brutal overwork and harsh conditions. So American intelligence estimate was tens or hundreds of thousands, and we cited that as well. We came out with no conclusion of our own about the numbers. In fact, we ended up by saying, well, maybe the 2 million figure will turn out to be right, even if it was totally fabricated. But tentatively, we assumed that American intelligence was probably right. Okay? Now let's turn to the last point. Now there's a lot of evidence. See, after the fall of the Pol Pot regime, a lot of evidence came out. Okay, I've now finished with everything I wrote about the topic, which was perfectly accurate. No one has ever found one minor error, even. There have been lies, like what you just heard, but no errors. Now let's turn to another question. What the actual numbers are. Well, here you can turn to subsequent scholarship. It's certainly not known in detail, but there is subsequent scholarship. In fact, there are two major sources at the moment. One of them is a book on the Pol Pot period by the only authentic Cambodia scholar who has written on the topic, Michael Vickery. He's actually American. In fact, he was actually in the Foreign Service. He's a specialist on Cambodia, speaks Khmer. His wife's family was all massacred by Pol Pot. He worked in the refugee camps and so on, and he has a book called Cambodia, 1975 to 1979, in which he gives a detailed demographic study, you know, region by region, putting together whatever evidence he could and so on and so forth. The book was very highly praised in England by Indochina scholars and so on and so forth. It's never been reviewed in the United States, though it was published here. His conclusion is that, except in marginal journals, in fact, a professor here reviewed it in the Monthly Review. I will tell you, because this is important, that's why. That's why. Let me, do you want to know the answer to this question or don't you? You don't, okay. Well, all right, let me just ask for a show of hands. How many people want me to give you this answer? Okay. Then, final remark. Do you want to hear what the scholarly record shows? Yes, okay. His estimate is that the total number who died above what would be expected if you had had regular population growth is about 700,000. There's another study by the one government that carried out an official inquiry into this, the government of Finland. Of course, again, never mentioned in the United States. They come out with somewhat lower estimates. The State Department journal Problems of Communism came out with a still lower estimate. There are people, incidentally, who are apologists for Pol Pot. The government scholar Douglas Pike, who now heads the Indochina Resource Center, according to him, Pol Pot was, I'm quoting, the charismatic leader of a peasant revolution under whom the population didn't suffer anywhere near as much as they said. However, I haven't said any of these things. I've just reported the facts. Now, why does that bother people so much? Because what Herman and I did was we took the position that it is not proper to lie, either in suppressing the crimes of your own state or exaggerating the crimes of an official enemy. And of course, the commissars who insist on the right to lie are outraged by this. Do you want to go on for the next lie, this one having been discussed?
Minutes, and I'm afraid to even say two sentences because it may equal 20 minutes.
Okay. Well, it may. As I said, it takes a phrase to produce a lie and some time to decode it.
Could I say something?
Go ahead.
I know I might be lynched any moment, but could I
go
say
ahead.
Something? I know I might be lynched, but I'm going to try.
It's your floor.
Thank you, sir. Thank you.
Go ahead.
Thank you. The microphone's been turned off.
Will you go ahead?
I don't have a microphone.
Now that we know about the two,
hello?
Will you go ahead?
All right. Yeah. We're back in business.
Go ahead.
You're the most adept sophist I've ever met.
Sorry?
You are the most adept sophist I have ever met.
Really? Okay.
If we
let the audience judge that.
Will the Nazis please be quiet? I would like to have a word, if I might. I will wait till they have had their say.
Do you have something to say?
I can't talk over that kind of the abuse being hurled at me.
Go ahead.
Now, would you silence your goon squad?
Would I what?
Silence your goon squad. I hear very
I can't hear the word
violent remarks are being thrown at me.
I'm sorry, I can't hear what you're saying. Would you talk?
I didn't vote for Reagan, I'm sorry.
Would you talk so that I can hear? Yeah.
Are you not understanding what I'm saying?
Now I understand. Go ahead. What was your question?
That's hard to deal with.
What is your question?
My question is that... Thank you for the silence. Now, you have described a world, a Nazified world controlled by the United States, and I think someone coming from Mars and hearing all this would think that's the state, that the world is controlled by the United States in a kind of terroristic network. And I'd be very surprised to go out into the world and find that, in fact, the allies of the United States and Europe and Japan that were reconstructed by the United States and helped by the United States, in fact, are the freest, most prosperous states in the world due mm-hmm. to the benevolence of the United States. Mm-hmm. That, in fact, the things that you attribute to the United States... Thank you. The things that you attribute to the United States... The things that you attribute to the United States, for instance, death squads in El Salvador, was an outrage, considered an outrage by the Carter administration, considered an outrage by Ambassador White, who was there. Carter cut off aid to Guatemala, excuse me. In fact, we had the ironic situation in 1979 and 1980 of the United States sending emergency aid to the government of the Sandinistas, and which is a pro-communist, Marxist-Leninist group of people, and the United States was aiding them. At the same time, the United States was denying aid to the anti-communist government of Guatemala because of its human rights abuses. Now, that's a kind of twist that doesn't quite fit into your conspiratorial theory,
right,
which includes the media, and everything is all kind of in a big ball, and everybody's just working towards this untruth.
Okay. Well, you gave three examples. Shall I comment on those? First, you said that the Carter administration was opposed to death squads and Ambassador White was opposed to them. Second, you said the United States stopped military aid to Guatemala under Carter. And third, you said the United States was sending aid to the Sandinistas. So let's take those three. Ambassador White, until the moment that he left the government, supported what was happening. You will find no criticism on his part. The Carter administration claimed officially in 1980, when the death squads really went into operation, when the bishop talked about the war of extermination and genocide against a defenseless civilian population, that was under Carter, remember, that was the year that 10,000 people were killed. The Carter administration officially was saying that it didn't know who was doing it, that the centrist government was under attack by the terrorists of the left and terrorists of the right, and we have to continue to support the centrist government. It later leaked out, that the press was saying the same thing. Alan Riding, who's the top Central American, Latin American correspondent of the New York Times, later pointed out in the small print, I'm quoting virtually, that at that time the Carter administration was telling the press exactly what the human rights groups and the Salvadoran church were telling them, namely that 90% of the atrocities were due to the security forces and the death squads were simply part of the security forces. After he left the government, Ambassador White started saying the same thing. But in 1980, when he was there, he didn't. You can find this, if you want to go back to the press, you can find it there. If you want a secondary source, you can look, say, at Ray Bonner's book. He was the Times correspondent who was withdrawn from there, and he gives plenty of evidence about it, as do I. That's El Salvador. The death squads were implemented under the Reagan administration, and in fact, it's misleading to call them death squads because they were essentially the security forces that we were supporting, doing exactly what the assassinated archbishop said they would do. Military aid to Guatemala. Here you have to go back to the Pentagon records and you will find exactly what I said. Recall the words. Under Carter, military aid to Guatemala continued at virtually the norm. And that is true. It's in the Pentagon printouts. If you want a source, you can look at the most accessible source is an article by Lars Schultz, the guy I mentioned before, who's a leading mainstream specialist, State Department advisor, and so on and so forth. It's in a book, in an article called Guatemala, which appears in a book edited by Martin Diskin called Trouble in Our Backyard about 2 years ago. And in it, he just has a page of Pentagon printouts. And he points out that, contrary to what everyone says, the aid continued to flow. Now, if you want me to go through the details, I'll explain it. There are all sorts of devices to keep aid from flowing, even when you don't, when aid is not authorized. You can say it's in the pipeline. You can do all sorts of things. But the fact is there. You can check it up if you like. Incidentally, under Reagan, the official aid stopped, but the unofficial aid, the illegal aid, escalated. That has recently been been developed in great detail by another Latin American correspondent, a very good one named Alan Nairn. You can find an account of it in the August issue of The Progressive in response to a State Department claim and in earlier articles of his there, which are referred to. In fact, the military aid, including even tanks and so on under Reagan, went way up by essentially the kind of mechanisms that you see in the Hassenfuss case, you know, a complicated deal through Belgium and so on and so forth. That's the second point. Now, what about the aid to the Sandinistas? That's an interesting one. That, in fact, is true, but you got to look a little closer. The Carter administration, what happened is the following, and I'm sorry if this takes a little time, but truth is not easy. When the Sandinista, Carter supported the Somoza regime till the very end, the very end, when it was obvious that Somoza couldn't be saved any longer, Carter proposed that the National Guard be retained, but Somoza leave. It's a system that they called their Somocismo without Somoza. Exactly the same system, because it was the National Guard, the terrorist army, that controlled the population. Somoza was dispensable as far as we were concerned. So Carter's last proposal, this is in fact that, you know, up to the day in which Somoza fled, was to keep the National Guard and to replace Somoza with some other thug. Furthermore, Carter arranged for one of our clients, Israel, to provide aid to Somoza till the very end. Israel cannot send aid unless we agree. They're much too dependent. And 98% of Somoza's aid was coming from Israel till the last day. In fact, there were still ships on the way. So we supplied him and tried to keep him in business till the end. All right, he couldn't be maintained. The National Guard was driven out. The United States immediately began to rescue the National Guard. We reconstituted them on the border using Argentine neo-Nazis, proxies, as our own specialists in terrorism say, and on, so on. All right, now what happens to the aid? Well, here's what it was. You take a look back, and this is what you'll find. Carter proposed $117 million of aid to the new government. That aid, if you look at it, was directed to the private sector. Now, and furthermore, the domestic support for the aid was international banks. Why? Because international banks had lent money. This is part of the whole Latin debt business. They had lent now, you know, here we get to the ultimate in hypocrisy, really the ultimate. People, now we find Americans referring to this last-ditch effort to block social reform as a sign of American benevolence. That's monstrous. Next.
Hopefully we can look forward to some more illuminating articles by Frank.
Pardon? I didn't catch that.
That's okay. On the way in here, we were a number of us were given material about Israel and Zionism. I'm wondering if you can give us some brief examples of the connection between Israel and, let's say, Guatemala, El Salvador, and Somoza's Nicaragua.
Okay. I think, given the time, I'm afraid I can't answer, but let me just refer you to some sources. Well, the general fact is that, as in many other parts of the world, Israel did serve as the agent of the Carter and Reagan administration to circumvent the fact that the Congressional Human Rights Campaign had put certain constraints on their ability to participate in genocide. So we did it through Israel, not only Israel, Taiwan, Argentina, Israel. There's a network of pariah states that we use for that purpose, Saudi Arabia and so on. But Israel is the best because they're the most dependable since they're totally dependent. That's one of the reasons we maintain the military confrontation in the Middle East and block peace, incidentally. We want to keep them dependent. They're technologically advanced. It's highly militarized. They're really good at it. So it's a Sparta. You know, the United States wants to keep them that way. And they were very good at it, and in fact, they provided the computer systems which enabled the Guatemalan government to keep track of, to monitor electricity and water flow in apartments in Guatemala City, so that if some apartment seemed to have too many people in it, they could send in the death squads to get rid of them, and various things like that worked pretty well. The so-called model villages, which are a system for controlling the rural population in a vicious fashion, I should say. They also organized that and so on. That's Guatemala. The same is true in a lot of other places. If you want some details on it, there's some stuff in my book, Turning the Tide, and a lot of references. You'll find a lot of material in a journal called Israeli Foreign Affairs, if the library has it. They may not. If you can wait a little bit, there's a new book coming out there's an article by Cheryl Rubenberg, who's a professor at Florida State University, which just came out. If you write me a letter, I'll tell you. I forget where it appeared. Anybody? Slips my mind. It just appeared in I think a British journal, if I'm not mistaken, but that's about Israeli aid in Guatemala. And there's a book coming out, should be out in a couple of months, by an Israeli scholar named Beit Halahmi, Beit-Halahmi. He's a professor at Haifa University, who goes through this. This is in English. He goes through this and other similar things in great detail. So there are some sources you can look at, you know, for details. There's just no time to go into it.
With respect to disinformation and political and social rhetoric, would you comment on the uses of humor historically and their kind of relative impact to other methods of straight education and editorial in dealing with shifting political awareness?
Let me suggest that I not answer. It's an interesting question, but I think it's enough off track so that, given the hour, if you don't mind, I won't answer. Yeah.
I'm interested in hearing you speak on the terms...
I'm sorry, it's hard for me to hear.
I'd like to hear you speak on the terms liberal and conservative.
Which terms?
Liberal and
liberal conservative.
Liberal and conservative. Since you obviously use conservative to, in a much more narrow sense.
Well, I use it in its dictionary sense.
It's rather ambiguous in terms of what is to be conserved.
Right. Okay. I mean, the terms of political discourse are at best not models of clarity. And in fact, liberal and conservative are interesting in that they've just shifted around totally. What is now called conservative in the dictionary sense was called liberal in the late 19th century. There's a whole set of ideas called classical liberalism, represented by a lot of Enlightenment figures. Some of the most important, for example, are Wilhelm von Humboldt, who inspired John Stuart Mill, and Mill himself, and, you know, it goes back to Locke, and that tradition, classical liberalism. Nowadays, that's called conservatism. It should be. That's what should be called conservatism. When the term is used properly, that's called conservatism. It's opposition to state power. You know, in fact, this is a lot of what the part of the underlying conception of the United States government was before it became a state capitalist system in the 19th century. If we go back to the 18th century, the conception was basically this. We imagine a society of essentially equal people. Now, in fact, if you look, it was equal white male property owners. But if you put that aside, a society of equal people, roughly equal, and what barriers are there to liberty? Well, slavery, the church, and the state. Okay, so therefore we got a weakened state power, weakened church power, and end slavery. Ideas of that sort are basically classical liberalism developed with a good deal of sophistication. And a modern conservative, like say Taft, wants to cut back state power, to cut back say state intervention in the economy, same with someone like Mark Hatfield, to preserve the Enlightenment ideals of freedom of expression, of freedom from state violence, law-abiding states and so on and so forth. That's roughly modern conservatism. There's almost no conservatives these days. As I said, Hatfield's one, I'm another. You can find a couple of others. The way the term conservative is now used, it's used for people like Reagan. That is, people who want to expand the power of the state, to increase state intervention in the economy, to protect the state from public surveillance, to destroy civil liberties, to tear the whatever there is of law to shreds, and so on and so forth. That has nothing to do with conservatism. Now, what about liberalism? Well, liberalism, as I said, used to mean what I just described. Just a second. I'll call on you in a second. If you want to talk, go back to the mic. Liberalism used to mean what I just described. The modern term liberalism, however, means something quite different. I don't know exactly when, certainly since the 1930s, liberalism has meant a commitment to the use of state power for welfare purposes. You know, so New Deal type measures and so on. That's very different from classical liberalism. In fact, what it is it sort of sheds off towards modern social democracy. Okay? Now, you can make some sense out of these terms. They all have some sort of vague meaning. But the new meaning of the term conservative, as applied to the Reaganites, that has no meaning at all. These guys are the opposite of conservative in any sense, on any issue you can think of. They are fanatic statists. They believe in state power and state violence, an expansion of state power. They believe in lawlessness, you know. It has nothing to do with conservatism. The fact that, you know, you can even use the word conservative to refer to this is astonishing. As I say, if Robert Taft heard this, he would turn over in his grave. These are all the things he fought against, any conservative fought against.
Yes, could you speculate briefly on the impact that the dismissal of the diplomats from the United States and USSR will have on our future?
I'm sorry, it's very hard to hear. Could you say it again?
Could you speculate on the impact of the dismissal of the diplomats in the U.S. and the USSR?
Well, I mean, the impact will be to somewhat harshen relations between the two powers. I don't think it'll have a major impact, frankly. The reason is, I think both sides want to keep talking. The Russians want to keep talking because they're in trouble. Gorbachev would, I mean, the Soviet society is in fact a dungeon, no doubt. It's a totalitarian dungeon, you know. But the fact of the matter is that the government, the Gorbachev government, wants to devote resources towards domestic needs and to turn them away from the arms race for all kinds of reasons. For one thing, because they're scared, you know, for one thing, because they're trying to be a more benevolent dictatorship and so on and so forth. That means they need negotiations. That's why Gorbachev has made this incredible series of offers. I mean, it's unbelievable when you think about it. Virtually, you know, most of it isn't even reported here. But just think what they've offered lately. I mean, for over a year now, they've had a unilateral test ban. Okay? They the last offer, they offered to withdraw all of their intermediate range missiles and to permit Britain and France not only to maintain their missile force, but even to improve it. That was never, I don't even think that was mentioned here. I mean, we somehow pretend that the British and French missiles don't hurt when they hit. They do. They're just like anybody else's missiles. Doesn't matter whose name is on them. But they were willing to withdraw their missiles and let the British and French missiles remain. They have proposed a breaking elimination of the PACT system. It's astonishing, you know. I don't know if they mean it, since the United States was terrified and immediately backed down. We never pursued it. But Gorbachev proposed dismantling NATO and the Warsaw Pact. Well, you know, if Americans cared at even minimally about Poland, say, or Hungary, we'd jump at that opportunity. I mean, we don't need NATO to control Germany, you know, France, but they do need the Warsaw Pact to control Poland. So if we even had a marginal interest, I mean the U.S. government and U.S. elites, if they had even a marginal interest in the welfare of the Poles, which of course they don't, they would at once leap at this opportunity and see if you could pursue it. I mean, no Soviet government in the world, even if it's run by liberal Democrats, is ever going to withdraw its control over Eastern Europe if Germany is part of a hostile military alliance. That's transparent. I mean, Germany alone almost destroyed Russia not long ago. Germany as part of a hostile military alliance is a real threat. I mean, they happen to have real threats. We don't, but they do. They're surrounded by powerful enemies in Western Europe, in Turkey, and elsewhere. We're not. So they proposed the dismantling of the pacts. Well, you know, we fled from that one. It was not even mentioned here. They proposed withdrawing all fleets from the Mediterranean, Russian and American fleets from the Mediterranean. That's extremely important. The Russian and American fleets have repeatedly come into confrontation in the Mediterranean. Every time there's an Arab-Israeli war, the Soviet-American fleets come into confrontation. In fact, back in 1967, we almost went to war over that. McNamara's testified about it. The two fleets came into confrontation, and it's happened over and over. That's the way a nuclear war is most likely to start. Well, okay, they're offering to withdraw the two fleets. Now, you know, for us, the Mediterranean is much less significant than it is for them. I mean, for them, the Mediterranean is kind of like the Caribbean is for us. That's their only, even more, it's their only warm water exit. But they're willing to withdraw their fleet, they say. We won't pursue it. And on and on. So they've made a number of really astounding proposals, which we don't want to accept, the United States does not want to accept. So I think, from their point of view, they're going to try to play down this conflict. Now, what about from the Reagan point of view? I don't think the Reagan administration wants any kind of a settlement. They would like to have a reduction of number of missiles for the reason I mentioned, because it's totally insignificant and irrelevant, and our comparative advantage is not in production anyway. You know, in fact, our missiles are now using Japanese components. That's in fact true. We're increasingly relying on Japan and even South Korea for the most sophisticated parts of our own missiles, because this Pentagon system of public subsidy is so inefficient, it's extremely inefficient, that we can't compete with our industrial rivals. So production of missiles is not a big business for us. The American comparative advantage is in new technology, and they got to keep that going, and we have no other method other than the Pentagon so far. It's very hard to think of another one. So they're going to keep the confrontation going. They need a shield for intervention. They need a way to force the public to subsidize high technology, and therefore they might accept, in fact, they'll welcome reduction in actual level of armaments, but they're always going to keep insisting on continual improvement for these reasons. That's where we're ahead, and that's the way we keep our industrial system going. But nevertheless, the Reagan administration does want to talk. And the reason is, again, they're afraid of their major enemy, the domestic population, both here and in Europe. You got to shut them up. You don't want too much turmoil in Europe. You don't want too much turmoil here. So the way you do it is continuing to show a willingness, a forthcoming willingness to participate in negotiations and so on and so forth. You want to look at disinformation. Look at the way they handled that Reykjavik summit. It's magnificent, They came out of the Reykjavik summit with George Shultz with a long face and everybody with a long face, all on television saying, oh God, it was a catastrophe, a disaster. Then they realized that's not going to play in Peoria. So they switched 180 degrees, and all of a sudden George Shultz comes on beaming and Reagan comes on beaming. It was a fantastic success, And the whole press switches around, like parrots. Yes, it was a fantastic success. Everybody loves it, 3-to-1 support. It's like trained parrots. And they got to keep doing that because, you've got to worry about your primary enemy, the domestic population. You got to keep them quiet. So to get back to your comment, I don't think that this is going to have a big effect because each side, for quite different reasons, wants to keep the discussions going. I was told only one more question, and it'll have to be from this side since the last one was from that side, so go ahead.
Well, in the United States, there's a segment of the...
Was what?
There's a segment of the industrial portion of the United States that makes a tremendous amount of money off the arms race, but in the Soviet Union, they don't apparently have that. They don't have a system with a where people get rich off of the arms race. That's one reason to believe they're sincere in offering to stop testing and to dismantle their portion of the arms race. Are there any other reasons to believe that they're insincere? Are there ways in which they really may gain or profit from the arms race?
Well, your point is very important. They don't have exactly the same motives that we do to keep the military system going. Nevertheless, you'll notice that they have also been dedicated to building up their military system way beyond any conceivable need of defense. They have actual security problems, which we don't, But nevertheless, their arms buildup has been well in advance of any such reasonable defensive needs. So why do they do it? As you say, it's not, this is a command economy. People just follow orders. So you don't have to get the public to subsidize the industry, through devious means. But it is a society based on, it's a state based on force. It's a state based on force and violence. First of all, the Soviet Union itself is an empire internally. The thing that's colored red on the map, that's an empire run by a Russian minority with complex ethnic groupings which are not small, like 40 million Muslims, and I don't know how many Ukrainians, but plenty of them. There's a whole pile of people within that internal empire, and basically they're controlled by force. Furthermore, they control their own population by force. A Leninist state of the sort established in 19... I think one of the big... I talked about some of the techniques of use of terminology to delude. One of the most extreme such cases is the use of the term socialism to refer to the Soviet Union. The Leninist coup, the Bolshevik coup in 1917, and that's what it was. It was a coup, not a revolution. There was a popular revolution, but it was taken over by a managerial elite who immediately dismantled all the socialist institutions. They dismantled the workers' councils, they dismantled the Soviets, and they placed the state in the hands of a revolutionary vanguard of of managerial intellectuals, rather like the statist intellectuals in the West, I should say, who took power on the backs of a popular revolution, dismantled the popular institutions, and turned the country into what they themselves call a labor army. That's what Trotsky was calling it in mid-1918, a labor army which will be subordinated to the needs of the leader, who will drive them on to utopia, and so on and so forth. That's a dream of the intellectuals way back. You know, it's almost a disease of the intelligentsia to use state power, to use state power which you can attain on the basis of popular struggles, so that you can then create a properly managed society run by smart intellectuals, where everybody does his job and does what he's told, and it'll all work fine. Okay, that's Leninism. That's the exact opposite of socialism. I mean, if socialism means anything, it means workers' control of production, and then on from there. And that's the first thing they destroyed. So why do we call it socialism? Well, we call, and incidentally, if you're running that kind of society, you need violence. That's why that's the answer to your question. That's why they build up their system. First, the internal empire, then because they need violence to run that managerial state, which is just kind of an extreme form of what Western so-called liberals want, too. You know, it's one of the reasons they shift so easily from being communists to celebrating America and so on and so forth. And furthermore, they've got Eastern Europe to contend with. As long as we keep Germany in a hostile military alliance, they're certainly going to control Eastern Europe, and they're going to do it by force, because there's no other way. So now, a last comment, which is not exactly your question. Why is this stuff called socialism? Well, you see, here you have one of the rare cases where the two major propaganda systems in the world agree on something, agree on a certain form of deception. And when that happens, it's very hard to extricate yourself from it. Why do they agree? Well, the United States propaganda system wants to call that socialism so as to defame socialism, right? To destroy the idea that there could really be popular democratic control over the basic institutions of the society. That's hated by American elites, so if you can associate it with a Soviet dungeon, great. That's why we call it socialism on this side. What about their propaganda system? Well, you know, they are trying to get the maximal mileage that they can out of the moral force, which is quite real and quite justified, that's associated with the socialist ideals. And in fact, libertarian socialism, in my view, is the true inheritor of classical conservatism and liberalism. Could go into that if you like. But they want to get, when you really think through what the classical liberals were saying, in a society in which it's not just the state and the church that are powerful institutions that dominate, but the state, the church, and corporations. They didn't think of that. That's something later. But the same ideals under these new circumstances lead you right on to libertarian socialist ideals. And people understand that. A lot of people understand that outside the United States. The United States is an intellectually and culturally very backward area where these topics can't be discussed. But in other parts of the world that are less controlled, they can be. And there's a certain, proper kind of moral prestige or aura associated with these libertarian ideals. And the Soviet leadership would like to, gain for themselves whatever they can by association with them, so they call their system socialist, and we call that system socialist in order to defame it by associating socialism with them. So everybody calls it socialist, and that's one of the most terrific techniques for destroying socialism that exists. If you want more stuff on this, I have an article that just came out called The Soviet Union Versus Socialism, which was in fact sent to a Marxist journal who wouldn't publish it, though they commissioned it, and it later came out in an anarchist journal, and I go into this somewhere else. I'm sorry, but I was told we got to stop.
I wanted to thank Paula for doing these signings. She had to leave. She didn't realize this would go on quite so long, that he had this much...